Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, national outrage is growing after two people were killed by federal immigration agents in Minnesota. Now, organizers in Pike County say ICE activity closer to home is raising alarms. We'll speak with Delaware Valley Action about a candlelight vigil, rapid response efforts, and what residents are experiencing on the ground. As a cold snap grips New York, many residents are seeing higher gas bills even while they're trying to use less heat. We'll break down what's driving the increase and what regulators can do about it. Plus, some big energy decisions today in Albany. We'll get a live update from the state capitol on what it means for New Yorkers. And don't let the cold freeze your weekend plans. Winterfest at Roscoe Mountain Club has snow, s'mores, and live music to keep you moving. Details coming up after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is expected to be questioned this hour about the Trump administration's military operation in Venezuela. NPR's Michelle Kellerman says he's appearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
In his prepared remarks, Secretary Rubio defends the military operation to oust President Nicolas Maduro and says the U.S. will help Venezuela transition from a, quote, criminal state to a responsible partner. He says he's keeping a close watch on former vice president and now interim leader Delcy Rodriguez, who he says has promised to open up Venezuela's energy sector to American companies. The ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Jean Shaheen, says in her prepared remarks that the U.S. has traded one dictator for another in Venezuela. And she says the U.S. naval blockade around Venezuela is costing American taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump is threatening Iran again. Writing online this morning, he told Iran to come to the table to negotiate a deal with no nuclear weapons. Trump says if Iran does not make a deal, the next attack, quote, will be far worse. Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar was rushed last night as she spoke at a Minnesota town hall meeting. A man sprayed a liquid on her, and he was tackled and arrested as he tried to run away. Omar's office says she is fine. The attack came hours after President Trump again insulted and denigrated Omar. He was speaking to a crowd in Iowa. Trump says he is swapping out his immigration leads in Minnesota. He told Fox News' The Will Cain Show that his border czar is now in the state to help reduce tensions.
We have Tom Homan there now. We put him in there. He's great. And they met with the governor, the mayor, everybody else, and we're going to de-escalate a little bit.
But the extent of that de-escalation is not clear. It comes after two Minneapolis protesters were killed this month by federal agents. Stocks opened mixed this morning as Amazon announced another big round of job cuts. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 2 points in early trading.
Amazon says it's cutting about 16,000 corporate jobs. That's on top of 14,000 layoffs by the online retailer last October. UPS used to deliver a lot of packages for Amazon, but the Brown delivery trucks are scaling back that business. UPS says it's cutting up to 30,000 jobs. Starbucks sales got a caffeinated jolt in the final months of 2025. The quarter brought the company's first jump in U.S. sales in 2 years. Global sales were also up, but quarterly profits fell short of forecasters' expectations. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer is visiting China after a similar trip by Canada's Prime Minister earlier this month. Both countries are hoping to expand trade ties with the world's second largest economy. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. Power crews are making gains on electricity outages across the country. Nearly 400,000 customers are still in the dark after last weekend's winter storm. That number is down from more than 1 million outages. The greatest number of power outages are still in Tennessee and Mississippi. The Trump administration has quietly rewritten some rules for nuclear safety and security. NPR's Jeff Brumfield obtained a copy of the rules and reports there are some substantial changes.
The changes apply to experimental reactors currently under construction at the Department of Energy. The department wants to get three or more of those reactors running by July 4th of this year. To help meet that deadline, officials rewrote internal rules for safety, security, and environmental management, then sent the rules to the companies building the reactors without making them public. Catherine Huff, who is a nuclear engineer at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, is critical of the decision.
in the best world, the public should expect as much openness from the government as is possible.
NPR's analysis found the new rules loosened groundwater restrictions, security requirements, and more. The Energy Department has said safety remains a top priority for the program. Jeff Brumfiel, NPR News.
A research group estimates casualties from the war in Ukraine could be nearly 2 million by this spring. That's at least 1.2 million Russian troop deaths, wounded, or missing, and then half that number from Ukraine. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, celebrating a century of supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org/100.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for being with us. National attention has turned to federal immigration enforcement, especially after the fatal shootings of Alex Pretty and Renee Nicole Good by federal immigration agents in Minneapolis, incidents that have sparked nationwide protests and calls for accountability. Locally, residents in and around Pike County are organizing responses and resistance. With us are Taylor James, board member of Delaware Valley Action, and co-president of DVA, Martha Ramon. DVA is Pike County's local indivisible group. Thank you for both being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Taylor, you're organizing a candlelight vigil for Alex Pretty tonight. Why was it important for Delaware Valley Action to organize this vigil here in Pike County, and why now?
Yes, absolutely. So tonight at 6:30, we're all meeting. We are pretty much the organization in town that responds, I think, when our community needs things. And we have a lot of empathetic, beautiful people in our area who were really heartbroken and horrified by what happened in Minnesota. And we really just needed to bring them together to mourn and to kind of have a place to place all of this energy that we're feeling. We were able to have a vigil a few weeks back for Renee, and it was a really beautiful and unifying night for our community. And so we feel it's our responsibility as a community organization to kind of rise up and provide these opportunities for our people to come together and to be around people who are feeling the same pain they're feeling right now, you know?
And we'll get folks details about that candlelight vigil later before we go. But with so much of the national attention focused on Minnesota, ICE has been seen in the Catskills, Northeast Pennsylvania, the Hudson Valley. What are you hearing or observing locally that's raised alarm bells for folks in the area?
So I think what we see is people are very concerned about the violence nationwide, not what we are about. And so we want to express that, although our vigil tonight is really to mourn and to express our outrage at the senseless killing in Minneapolis.
Earlier this month, DHS published a notice of activity to purchase that Pep Boys warehouse in neighboring Orange County for an ICE processing facility. What was your reaction there in Pike County, you know, right next door, right in our backyard?
Yep. Well, we have some strategies we're working on for the coming year. But again, we really want to focus tonight on mourning the senseless loss of life.
I think that a lot of our people and our community members are horrified by any news that this is coming closer to us. And I think everyone's feeling that in their own communities, because while it is crazy in Minnesota, we are seeing little pockets of it all over. And so, I think we are kind of looking at our national leadership. We're looking at Indivisible, and we're trying to figure out what the best move forward is to continue providing safe spaces and kind of a response to this while making sure that our people and our community is safe and strengthened and able to kind of rise up to these moments.
Are there particular...
Go ahead. Delaware Valley Action is really, like Taylor said, committed to being engaged in issues that affect us locally and nationally, and we'll just continue to do that.
Are there any particular communities or institutions like schools, faith groups, employers that you're hearing from about the chilling effect that this ICE enforcement has across the country? Right there?
There will be faith leaders with us this evening to mourn the loss of life. Yes, and we do hear
all the
time.
Yeah, that's who we've reached out to.
Community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much right away as was connecting with our faith leaders in our area and organizing these vigils alongside them so that, because I think a lot of faith leaders are seeing this and it's not what they stand for.
You're also organizing a rapid response network. What does that look like in practice if ICE activity increases here?
We're still working
on the details of that. Yeah. Sorry, Taylor. And
no, you're good.
And we are getting responses from our community, and then we will effectuate a strategy for that.
I think we're working closely
with Indivisible and other organizations. We're really looking at national leadership and Minnesota to see what our response is, but we're in the really early phases of that. But really, whatever we can provide to make people feel safe and to protect our community members, we're going to go out of our way to do that.
About 7 days ago, last week, NPR was taking a road trip through Trump country to hear what MAGA folks thought about what's going on. They were in Pike County, and the reporter said this place is so conservative, some locals call it Trump County, Pennsylvania. What are you guys hearing in your neck of the woods there from folks who may support these actions that the administration is taking in Minnesota and elsewhere?
I don't think we've seen a difference.
Taylor, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't really think we've seen a difference in that end. I think we've just seen our community members kind of becoming more heartbroken and more willing to gather and kind of rise up to these moments. But I haven't seen a change really at all personally in that sense. Maybe they're being a little quieter, but I don't see anyone in our neck of the woods really denouncing anything.
Martha?
No, I would agree, and we certainly don't want to speak for MAGA folks about what they're feeling, but I think pretty much the same that you've heard with actions that have happened in the past.
Are you engaged with any other local Pike County or Pennsylvania state officials about concerns that you guys have, or is there any response there at that level?
We are. I believe there's action being taken today in Fetterman's office, and some of our members are part of that. Mm-hmm.
And Martha, as a leader of Delaware Valley Action, how do you guide people through organizing when fear and grief are such a large part of the conversation?
So we have a long history. Delaware Valley Action was formed in 2016. So our community, it knows that they can come to Delaware Valley Action to express their feelings and to demonstrate and to be with community. And so we have quite a history at this point.
Taylor, from the board's perspective, how do you make sure community voices, especially maybe some who may be afraid to speak publicly, are reflected in your actions?
I think it's been a lot about creating spaces and opportunities for our community to come together that aren't necessarily politically charged. Just like our events at our space, our game nights, our art club, like little things like that, where we get to still touch base and have conversations with people, and then we get to really let that inform our response as a board and as a group. Is like creating these opportunities where people come and they just sit down with us and talk to us. That really informs a lot of how we go and we speak to our elected officials and we shape these resistance and these protests and these demonstrations is just from having opportunities to sit down with the community in our space. We have a free store that we've opened alongside our food pantry that serves the entire community. So we do get to speak to people from all walks of life because everyone uses our free store. And so I think a lot of those conversations that just happen organically and just happen at a community level, I think those really shape everything we do. We're not going to be the same as the group that's organizing in Philly or in Minnesota or in Utah or wherever. because we're like this little rural area, and we have a lot of our people have specific needs, and I think without having that open table, we wouldn't be able to explore those things.
And let's give folks details about the candlelight vigil that's being held tonight for Alex Preti. Where is that happening, and how can folks get involved?
Absolutely. Got that, Martha?
Go ahead. Oh.
So it's 6:30 tonight at 315 Broad Street in Milford. For more information, you can check us out on our social medias or Delaware Valley Action or our website. Just look up Delaware Valley Action. And if you want to get more involved, come out tonight. Definitely make sure you get on our mailing list. And if you can't make it tonight, please try to come to one of our next demonstrations. Please come to our next meeting. We meet monthly. I think it's every second Wednesday of the month down at our community center. And there's something for everyone at our center. So there is so many opportunities to get involved. We are doing so much. We have this really galvanized, incredible board that is constantly working, constantly coming up with ideas. And we want people to be a part of it. We want them to join us. We want their input. So please come check us out.
And open to folks beyond Pike County. I know your focus is Action in Pike County, but as part of Delaware Valley, are and people that might want to participate and support open to those folks too?
Yeah, we have. Absolutely. We often have people come from New Jersey and New York to our Action. So very, very welcome, both to our meetings and to our demonstrations.
Martha, anything
else? And we do have a Zoom option, so they can join virtually if they ever want to as well.
Good to know. And Martha, anything else you want to add before we go?
No, I think we're looking forward to being with community this evening and expressing our sadness at the state of the country and also to the families of both Renee Good and Alex Preti. So I think we're looking forward to being together.
Yeah. That was Martha Raymond and Taylor James from Delaware Valley Action on how Pike County is responding to immigration enforcement locally. To learn more, get involved, visit their website or social media, and stay tuned as we continue covering these community efforts as well. Taylor, Martha, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you.
Up next, it's cold out, and for a lot of New Yorkers, the gas bill is about to sting. Coming up, why using less gas doesn't necessarily mean paying less. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills. From inpatient and outpatient care to primary, urgent, and specialty care with Garnet Health doctors in Sullivan County. Exceptional lives here. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
This week in This American Life, 911 calls about ICE agents from around the country.
I've got two vehicles that are in Border Patrol and they're following me. And I'm a U.S. citizen, and there's actually four of them trying to ram into my car. Can you please send someone ASAP?
They're calls from emergency rooms, business owners, and immigration agents themselves.
I'm a Border Patrol agent. They stole my uniform.
That's this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill. NPR Music is looking for the next great undiscovered musician to play the tiny desk. If you're an unsigned artist, record a video of yourself playing one original song behind a desk and submit it to the 11th annual Tiny Desk Contest by February 9th. And if you win, you'll play your very own Tiny Desk concert. Think you've got what it takes? Learn more at wjffradio.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As this cold snap settles across New York and Pennsylvania, a lot of people are bracing for higher gas bills, even if they're doing everything they can to conserve. A new analysis suggests the biggest driver isn't how much gas people are using, but the rising cost of maintaining and expanding gas pipelines in New York. Joining us now is Jamie Van Nostrand, Policy Director at the Future of Heat Initiative and former chair of the Massachusetts Department of Public Utilities. Jamie, thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
There's a study out about an analysis out about how New Yorkers are using less gas than they did a few years ago, but their gas bills keep going up. What's driving this disconnect?
Well, it's helpful to point out that the price of gas really hasn't changed, and the price of the gas itself really hasn't changed that much over the last decade or so. It's the cost of delivering that gas that's driving up bills. Our analysis shows that in New York, about three-quarters of your bill represents the cost of delivering the gas, not the gas itself. The cost of the gas itself is only about one-quarter of the bill.
What are those charges, those gas delivery charges, and why do they now make up about 75% of typical gas bills for folks in New York?
A lot of those charges consist of the money that the gas companies are spending to replace pipes. That's where they make their money. They don't make any money on the gas itself. That's really set by the market forces, and it's just a pass-through. They make their money by investing more and more money in pipes. So they're replacing a lot of pipes in New York. The asset base for gas companies has increased by $20 billion over the last 10 years, from $17 billion to $37 billion, and most of that is replacing the pipes. And then there's the profits and financing costs that they incur to replace those pipes.
So if they're making profits by building and replacing pipes, not by selling gas, which is what you think they might be making money from, how does that incentive affect how much utilities spend and then how much customers end up paying?
It provides a very strong incentive for them to overspend on pipes, and that results in bills going up, and it's something that the Future Pete Initiative, we're working with state regulators to help them recognize that the issue of it's all about energy affordability, and one of the biggest things we can do to address affordability is to get gas company spending under control to really address that overspending on pipes, which is how they make money.
I want to address what the utilities are saying about this, but I've also, could you just explain a little bit more about what Future of Heat Initiative does and how it helps New Yorkers?
Yeah, we're a nonprofit. We work most on energy affordability issues, and what we're doing is working with state regulators around the country on this natural gas transition. Basically, we're seeing across the country, the natural gas sales are going down, and yet the spending on the gas system is going up, and it's just a matter of simple math. As more and more people get off the gas system and migrate to electric heat pumps, that gas sales are going to be going down. And if you can't get the spending on the pipes under control, it's just a matter of simple math, less sales, fixed costs are not changing. In fact, the costs are going up. That's going to result in massive increases in the delivery charge portion of the bill. So what we're doing with the Future of Heat Initiative is working with regulators and their staffs and helping them recognize this. It's all about energy affordability, and this is a real driver of the gas costs, gas bills.
And utilities say that pipeline replacement that we were talking about is about safety and reliability. How much of that spending is actually truly necessary, and what do you think goes beyond what's needed?
Well, we all want safe pipes. I mean, as long as the gas is moving through the system, it needs to be safe. But the gas companies are spending far more than is necessary to keep the system safe. It's all about profits. That's how they increase profits, by replacing pipes. And frankly, there are lower cost solutions. I mean, what the gas company is doing is pursuing the highest profit solution for the gas companies rather than pursuing the lowest cost solution for customers. Because rather than replacing the pipes, which is where they make the most money, you can do repairing or relining the pipes and keep them in service a little bit longer. Or the longer term solution is, rather than spending money on replacing pipes, people should be thinking about electrifying. And basically, we can decommission the pipes by getting neighborhoods off natural gas and take advantage of the technologies of electric heat pumps and electrify the homes and just start decommissioning the gas system. So as the sales go down, we need to be shrinking the gas system. Otherwise, rates are going to go through the roof.
And you mentioned state regulators. Explain to folks the role they play in either curbing or enabling these rising gas bills.
Well, the New York rates are set by the New York Public Service Commission. It's five commissioners, and they basically when a gas company wants to increase its rates, it needs to file a case in front of the commission. They review the evidence, and this is where the utilities want to spend. If the gas companies want to spend money on replacing pipes, that gets closely reviewed in these rate proceedings, and that's where the regulators can really ask the tough questions. Is this replacement really necessary? Is there a lower cost solution? Should you be looking at relining or repair versus replacing? So it's a very rigorous process, and that's why we're working with the commissioners around the country to really engage them and provide the technical assistance so they can analyze the issues and really take on the gas companies in the interest of keeping rates down for customers.
It's cold, we all know, outside this big cold snap, a pretty cold winter for New Yorkers struggling with high energy costs this winter. What does a delivery-heavy gas bill mean in real day-to-day terms?
I think it's a source of real frustration for customers because they're going to be doing everything they can to keep their gas use down, and they're not going to see much reduction in their bill because the delivery charge portion of it doesn't change that much as the volume goes down. So prices are, the price of the gas itself is going to be high because that's what happens when it's cold weather. The natural gas prices are increased, and then people want to use more gas because it's colder outside. But it's going to be very frustrating to make those efforts to reduce gas and not really see much of a change in your bills. That's why we really need to get the delivery charge portion of the bill addressed through rate proceedings.
And looking ahead, as New York uses less gas overall, what happens to the cost of maintaining that gas system and who ends up paying for it?
Ultimately, that's likely to be paid for by consumers, which is why we're really working hard with commissions around the country to consider, you know, this transition is underway. There are more and more customers are getting off natural gas and getting onto electric heat pumps. So those costs are, that those sales volumes are going down. And if we can't reduce the cost of the system itself, then it's just a matter of a simple math. The bills are going to be much higher. So it's really looking at those longer term and trying to minimize those stranded costs, which is one of the things. If more and more people electrify, then there's a greater risk that a lot of these costs of the system are going to be stranded. So we need to stop investing in natural gas infrastructure, more pipes in the ground, and thinking about the longer term solutions, which is electrification, because ultimately customers are likely going to have to bear all those costs. So that's why it's even more of an urgent problem that regulators need to address.
And what's next for the Future of Heat initiative in trying to address that and trying to get those minds changed at the regulator level?
I mean, one of the issues that's really tough to tackle, and New York has looked at in the legislature the last couple of sessions, is giving utilities the ability, the authority to substitute electric for natural gas. Because utilities right now will say, well, a lot of customers want to keep their gas, and if they're going to exercise their customer choice and say they want to keep their gas, and that keeps us from being able to decommission, you know, the pipelines. And so addressing, it's called the obligation to serve, but basically giving the commission the authority to allow electricity to be substituted for natural gas, so we can actually start shrinking the system. In other words, decommissioning some of the pipes rather than spending millions and millions of dollars on replacing the pipes. Just simply decommission them in favor of electrification. Right now, there's a statutory barrier to doing much of that in New York because of what's called the obligation to serve. So the legislature could really help out by addressing that issue and giving the commission and the authority to authorize the utilities to substitute electric service for gas.
And if folks want to learn more about Future of Heat Initiative, where can they go and learn more?
Future of Heat, just Google Future of Heat Initiative, or FOHI, F-O-H-I.
And there's
a website, and the affordability primer that you mentioned that looks at the cost of delivery charges in New York is, we have that one-pager or two-pager, I guess, that's available on that website.
Yeah, that's thefutureofheat.com, and you can find that under the publications tab. That's Jamie Van Nostrand from the Future of Heat Initiative explaining why some folks in New York are maybe paying more for gas even as they use less. Jamie, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Next, more energy news. New York's energy futures on the line, nuclear, data centers, and climate targets all in the mix as budget hearings get underway in Albany. We'll go live to Albany for more after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, we're going back to the archives for a 2020 conversation with Charlie Kaufman, the filmmaker and screenwriter behind movies like Being John Malkovich and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. He'll talk about filmmaking, his novel Antkind, and more. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Right now in Albany, state lawmakers are holding a key budget hearing that could reshape New York's energy future. From nuclear power to data centers and climate goals, the stakes are high and the debate is heating up. Joining us live from the hearing in Albany is New York Focus reporter Colin Kinnebrough, who's been following every moment and has an article out in New York Focus. Three questions for New York's climate and energy leaders. Colin, what's going on right now there in the hearing?
Hi, Tim. Well, right now, DEC Commissioner Amanda Lefton is on the stand taking questions from lawmakers on both the Senate and Assembly sides. So she's in charge of managing, you know, the state's environmental conservation agency. So far, we've heard questions. Some of the core ones that have been on my mind about the climate law, also about impacts to the agency from, you know, federal cuts and kind of the general federal pullback on environmental enforcement. But the hearing is really just getting underway. It's probably going to be going all day, maybe as long as 12 hours or more.
Yeah, let's give folks a little background on these budget hearings, and this hearing in particular. This week is kicking off a month-long marathon of budget hearings as lawmakers unpack Governor Kathy Hochul's budget proposal that she outlined last week. This hearing is specifically what and how are folks involved? Who's involved?
Right. So this is a standard part of the budget process. The governor laid out her budget proposal, just a week or so ago, and now lawmakers get to ask all their questions. This one is focusing on environmental conservation and energy issues. Climate is rolled in there, although it doesn't get mentioned in the title. So essentially, it's the chairs of the Environmental Conservation Agency, as I mentioned, DEC, the Public Service Commission, which regulates energy, NYSERDA, the energy research and development arm of the state, the Public Service Commission, and others. And then there will also be lots of, you know, advocates and other experts, business leaders who will be testifying over the course of the day as well.
We just came out of a segment with someone from the Future of Heat Initiative talking about how even as New Yorkers are using less gas, they're paying more. Gas certainly in the mix here when we're talking about these climate and energy goals in the state. And Governor Kathy Hochul has sort of changed her mind on a couple of those, including approving that three times rejected gas pipeline, delayed that ban on gas in new homes. And then also she's now championing nuclear power. Your article talks about, you know, some of the questions you'd ask. Let's start with your question about, I think you call it New York's all of the above energy strategy.
That's right. And those aren't my words. That's a line we've heard a lot from the governor and from others in her administration over the last year. And, you know, to my mind, it really calls back Democratic politicians, you know, back in the Obama era when the U.S. was really building out its, you know, fracking infrastructure and everything. But here we are talking about all of the above energy again. For the governor, that's included approving that gas pipeline, as you mentioned, that the state previously rejected. But she's also really emphasized nuclear, and I think has surprised people, at least me, with the scale of the build out she wants. Last year she talked about getting the power authority to build one or more power plants that would add up to 1 gigawatt of new energy. So that's essentially, you know, that could be just one large power plant. Now she's talking about potentially 4 more, or even more if they're smaller reactors that would be built by private companies. So that's quite ambitious. It sets the state up for, you know, potentially 10 years or more of planning, and certainly lots of debate and local fights over, you know, where these power plants are going to go and whatnot. So quite an ambitious proposal there.
What do you see as the key risks here and opportunities, I guess, of prioritizing reliability and energy diversity in the current budget when you compare that to the more traditional clean energy first approach?
Yeah, I think one thing, you hear a lot from the governor and her administration is that partly this is, you know, this shift in strategy from the renewables first approach, as you called it, is really driven by necessity, by the changing federal administration. You know, New York was counting heavily on offshore wind off the coast of Long Island to supply quite a lot of its energy, maybe up to about, you know, 15% of the state's entire energy supply. As your listeners probably know, Trump has really gone to war with offshore wind, and it's been touch and go even for the projects that are under construction. So, you know, by bringing more gas into Long Island, for example, and the New York City area, the governor would say she's just shoring up what's needed for reliability. The nuclear, as far as the risks, you know, with nuclear, I mean, a lot of environmentalists over the years, of course, have raised concerns about health, about nuclear waste and other things. I think these days when everyone's talking about affordability, I mean, the cost of these new plants is a major question on my mind, and I think on a lot of people's minds. Nuclear has been historically very expensive to build in this country. The last nuclear power plant that was built in the U.S. in Georgia is by some counts the most expensive power plant ever built on Earth. So, you know, can New York do it differently? I think that's a very open question. Everyone wants reliable energy, but no one wants their bills going up, and the governor has made a big point of that. So how she squares all of these things is an open question to me.
Yeah, that's one of the other questions you said you would ask if you had the chance to ask questions. How will you ensure that Governor Hochul's nuclear plans won't drive up New Yorkers' bills? And as you said, critics often argue that nuclear builds are costly and slow. I know this hearing is just getting underway, but are you hearing anything from state officials either justifying the economics of nuclear expansion or opposed to that idea?
We haven't heard that topic come up yet, honestly. So far, it's just been D.C. Commissioner Lefton up there. The agenda got a little bit reshuffled, and nuclear power is not really in her wheelhouse. We'll probably be hearing a lot more of that about that in the next panel. That's with the head of NYSERDA, Doreen Harris, and the chair of the Public Service Commission, and the head of the Power Authority, NYPA, Justin Driscoll. So I'm sure they will be getting a ton of questions about nuclear, but we haven't heard anything yet.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Colin Kinneborough from New York Focus. He's live in Albany as lawmakers are grilling top state energy and environmental officials as part of a marathon budget hearing today. His current article at nysfocus.com is 3 questions for New York's climate and energy leaders. We've clicked through 2 of your questions. I guess the third one here is about data centers. How does New York plan to make data centers pay their fair share?
Right. This is a concept that's been gaining a lot of traction. I mean, I started hearing about it kind of from climate and environmental groups and you know, consumer advocates sometime last year. I just saw that, you know, even Trump is talking about this now, that, you know, no regular customers should not be footing the bill for the power that all the power, the huge amount of power that data centers are drawing from the grid. I think in some states we have started to see that happen. And so it seems like there's really bipartisan interest at this point in making sure that, you know, as the governor put it, data centers pay their fair share. Either maybe they pay a little bit more for the power that they draw, or they even build their own energy on site. That's one approach that's been talked about. So far, we have not gotten any details on what the governor means by pay their fair share. I thought we might see some legislation, some draft legislation in the budget last week, but it wasn't actually in there. She's, as with many energy issues in New York, she's leaving it in the hands of the Public Service Commission, that sort of semi-independent agency that regulates utilities. So, maybe we'll get a preview today from the commissioner, Rory Christian.
Yeah. Can you read the tea leaves a little bit there? That you know, line in the State of the State putting the AI industry on notice, saying, you know, that they want to build in New York, they'll have to pay their fair share. That drew a lot of praise from environmentalists. And some of them have grown unused to cheering for the governor, as you report. But, you know, if she's not giving any details and sort of letting the Public Service Commission take, you know, charge here, or what does that tell you?
Well, at its core, this is an issue about, you know, rates, electric rates, which is really the commission's bread and butter. You know, they spend all their time deciding rate cases and getting into the nitty gritty of what kinds of customers pay what amounts. So in that sense, you know, it makes sense that they would be dealing with it. The way this happened in Oregon, which is the state you hear about from some of the climate advocates, the way they did this was to create a new rate class for these data centers, and that's something the Public Service Commission could certainly do here as well. The biggest kind of open question to me is if there is sort of a stipulation that these data centers bring, you know, supply their own power, how would they do that? What kinds of requirements would they be? Would there be? Would it have to be you know, purely clean energy, zero emissions energy, whether in the form of, you know, perhaps solar and batteries or something like a nuclear plant, or would they be allowed to build, you know, a gas plant, for example, as many data center companies have been doing in other states? Would they have to put some kind of, you know, carbon capture on it? So I think there's a lot of questions about not just the cost of building these data centers, but how they do so in a way that could mesh with the state's climate law.
Just going back to this all of the above strategy and this shift from Governor Hochul when it comes to climate and energy goals, how much of that do you think has to do with her bid for re-election?
That's a great question. I mean, I think certainly we've seen the tone shifting from Democrats across the country, you know, as it's become more challenging to build renewables, and there's been a lot of opposition from Washington. I think we've seen everybody across the political spectrum really embracing, you know, affordability and reliability as the core goals over, you know, cutting pollution. So it's hard to say. I mean, there are some things, for example, the state's cap and invest program that which was supposed to raise a ton of money for climate initiatives, kind of be a core way of how the state was going to implement its climate law, that is still up in the air and looks like it's potentially essentially just being punted until after November as it makes its way through the courts. So I think there could be very well be some political calculus here, but of course I can only speculate.
Do you think that that's an unresolved issue in New York's climate and energy policy that deserves a little bit more attention?
It is. I mean, there's been this, you know, perennial question ever since the climate law was passed back in 2019 of exactly how the state is going to fund this massive transition from, you know, fossil fuels to clean energy, you know, across buildings, transportation, right? Not just the power plants, but all these different aspects of our lives. I think that question remains open and became, you know, was there was kind of an answer in the form of this cap and invest program that the governor had put out. And then once she put that on hold, the question was thrown open again. Last year, they put $1 billion towards what they called the Sustainable Future Fund to fund climate programs. This year, that fund was, at least the governor is not proposing to renew it, although many in the climate world would like to see some more funding to that effect. So yes, very much still an open question.
I know you have to get back to the hearing, but before we go, what should listeners expect in the coming weeks as this budget and energy policy process moves forward?
Well, we're going to see the Senate and the Assembly putting together their responses, what's known as the One House budgets. Don't hold your breath. That probably won't be until maybe the beginning of March. And, you know, what we generally see is that particularly on issues like climate and the environment, they want to nudge the state towards spending a little bit more, putting more towards clean water infrastructure, for example, getting specific allocations towards things like lead pipes, that sort of stuff. And then specifically on climate, I wouldn't be surprised if there were some pushback on the fact that there is no new climate funding in the governor's proposed budget. So we might see a little bit of a fight over that.
That's Colin Kinnebrough from New York Focus. He is live in Albany at the hearing on energy, climate, and the environment as part of the month-long marathon of budget hearings in Albany. Lawmakers are grilling top state energy and environmental officials. We'll let you get back, Colin. I think you said that in recent years, this hearing has stretched to 12 hours or more, so I hope you brought a snack.
I certainly did.
Colin Kinnebrough, New York Focus. You can find more of his reporting at nysfocus.com. Colin, thanks.
Thank you. Great speaking with you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, don't ignore the cold. Celebrate the cold at Winterfest at Roscoe Mountain Club this Saturday. We'll get some details on that next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week we have adventures in tea with Henrietta Lavelle, who supplies the world's best restaurants. And we have the brilliant scientist cook Nick Sharma with great cooking tips for home cooks you've probably never heard before. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Hello, Radio Catskill listeners. This is Andy Carlson, and I'm inviting you to join me Thursday nights for 2 hours of genre-bending exploration of the American rock songbook on Ramble Tamble. I'll be bringing you everything from John Prine to PJ Harvey, Steely Dan to Steppenwolf, and just about everything in between. That's Ramble Tamble, Thursday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
With dangerously cold temperatures in the forecast, warming centers are open across our region to provide a safe, heated place for anyone who needs it. Locations are available at Sullivan, Ulster, and Orange counties, as well as Pike County in Pennsylvania. If you or someone you know needs a warm place to go, you can find a full list of locations and hours at wjffradio.org. Radio Catskill, keeping our neighbors connected.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at tavernonmainny.com.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, Saturday, Roscoe Mountain Club is embracing winter with a full afternoon of outdoor activities, live music, and local craft beer, Winterfest. Hosted in partnership with Roscoe Beer Company, runs from noon to 5 and features everything from ice skating and snowshoeing to ice carvings, fire pits, and family-friendly games. There's also some live music as well. To tell us more about what's planned, we're joined now by Tiffany Conklin of Roscoe Mountain Club. Tiffany, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You're not afraid of the cold. You're not afraid of a cold snap there at the Roscoe Mountain Club.
Not as afraid as I am of live radio.
You'll be fine. You've got this in the bag. So tell folks what Winterfest is all about. Why is it a highlight for Roscoe Mountain Club this year?
Well, I would say Winterfest is kind of like our love letter to the Catskills. It's about leaning into the season instead of hiding from it. It's an annual tradition that local communities can really look forward to, and also a great way to celebrate all the magic that happens in the Catskills during the winter.
I know a lot of people want to hide about right now and hibernate.
I know.
But what it is good to get out and enjoy. What are some of the main activities folks can enjoy, especially for those who maybe you've never been before?
I would say, you know, there's something for everybody, but the live music, local artisans and local businesses. They'll be selling jewelry, baked goods, coffee treats, kettle corn. Ice skating is a big hit. We also have live ice sculpting, horse carriage rides, bonfires with free s'mores, snowshoeing, sledding, snowman building competition. you name it.
And yeah, all those things sound like they're fun. Tell us a bit more about some of the specifics folks can experience, like with ice carvings. Are you letting folks ice carve themselves, or are these left best to professionals?
Oh, there's professionals there who will be doing that, but it's pretty mesmerizing to watch. The kids especially love it. The ice skating rink and the live music is the most lively and festive stuff happening. I'd say it's pretty much the heart of the day. Snowshoeing and carriage rides are a bit more of a quieter way to experience the landscape. And then there's going to be a lot of stuff going on indoors for kids, like crafts. And yeah, it's also dog friendly, so feel free to bring your pups. The brewery and the resort are actually dog friendly year round, so that's something to keep in mind as well.
Yeah. Well, what are some of the special activities or experiences geared toward families and kids?
I mean, honestly, everything. It's really an event that we wanted to make for families so that adults and kids can kind of just relax and have some good outdoor fun.
And they can also warm up inside if they need to as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have the Wolf Lodge where we'll have Far Beyond Gone playing. They start at 12:30. There's also a bar and food and some different pop-ups there. And then we have the barn where BJ will be playing starting at 1 p.m. That's not too far from the ice rink. There's going to be fire pits outside, some other activations as well, pop-ups, games, the game room over there. And then I think we're opening up 1907 for some pop-ups as well, just to give people more places to warm up. We've been doing a lot of prep work this week, a lot of plowing, just to make this Winterfest the best yet. We're doing everything we can to prepare for everyone to be comfortable and have fun.
And tell folks about 1907. Is that your restaurant?
Yes, that's the clubhouse/restaurant. Not too far of a walk. It's kind of between the barn and the inn. There's so many different locations.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. Roscoe Beer Company, a big part of the event, too. Any special craft beer or festive drinks that people can find?
You know, actually, this is actually a Roscoe Beer Company festival, and we are the ones who are hosting for them. This is their 12th annual festival. We're the sister company, so we host all of their larger events. We have 1,000 acres with all these amenities, so it's the perfect way to bring an outdoor beer and connect it to the great outdoors.
as a good sister would.
Tell
folks a little bit more about Roscoe Mountain Club. Folks may not be familiar with it, even though this resort has been around since 1926, just under a different guise.
Yes, exactly. We have an 18-hole golf course. We have a barrel sauna and a lake and a boathouse. We have the barn, which is the game room, and in the winters we have the ice rink. Wolf Lodge is usually for, it's a venue, a rental for weddings and also for corporate events, birthday parties, you name it. We do a lot of like really great gatherings for parties of like 30 or smaller. It's really intimate. It feels like you kind of have the whole place when you do that. And then we also have trails for snowshoeing and nature walks. And we have a lot of relationship with all the local guides, whether it's fly fishing or hunting. So if you reach out to us, we can kind of put together a package for you. We have some packages available, and we also have a fly fishing school that we're starting this year.
Cool. And for folks who've been around for a while, they may have known it as the Tanana Lake Golf and Tennis Club, but now Roscoe Mountain Club. And you mentioned for Winterfest, you're getting ready for it, doing a lot of plowing and getting it, you know, nice and accessible for folks. What logistical information should attendees know who are thinking about coming to Winterfest, you know, parking tickets or anything else that you want folks to know about?
So I would say I recommend carpooling just because there is a lot of snow, but again, we're doing a lot of plowing to clear everything up, and we're going to have, people guiding, cars when they arrive and letting them know where to park. We also will have some side-by-side cars that will help shuttle people. So, we're going to be coordinating everything. So when you arrive, you'll know where to go and where to be, including signage.
You mentioned this is the 12th annual Winterfest from Roscoe Beer Company. Mm-hmm. But if somebody's been coming, is coming for the first time, do you have a particular highlight of the day that you'd like to share?
Oh, that's a great question, because this is my first Winterfest.
Oh, cool.
So I'll have to get back to you on that. But what I can say about the festivals that I have been to since joining is that it's an incredible way to get to know the local community. Faces have become very familiar. I've gotten to know so many people that I wouldn't have met had it not been for these festivals. So, you know, these festivals are really important because they bring people together, and that's kind of what matters most and why we do it. It's a great way to support local artists and musicians, give families something to look forward to, and also, you know, introduce people who don't know the Catskills to what we have to offer.
Yeah, let's remind folks where they can get more information about Winterfest on Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, follow our social media channels for information, and you can always reach out to us. If you're not on social media, then you can just call or stop by the brewery.
And yeah. Also, RoscoeMountainClub.com, also on social media. And one more time, let's give folks the details, when it starts, how long it goes, and the two musical groups there.
Okay, so the festival starts at 12 p.m., and then we have Far Beyond Gone starting at 12:30 at Wolf's. We have BJ starting live music at 1 p.m. at the barn.
BJ Hendrickson.
Yeah, BJ Hendrickson. Sorry.
No, that's okay, folks. Folks, our listeners know him. He's been over here for a couple times.
So. Yeah, he's great.
He's great.
And then we also have an after party that starts at 5 p.m. and it goes, or 4 p.m. and it goes until 8 p.m. So the ice rink and the after party will be going until 8 p.m.
Oh, you didn't mention the after party before. Look at that. Breaking
I
news.
I forgot. We'll have a DJ little dance party.
That's cool. So you can stay warm. It's Winterfest. It's a Roscoe Beer Company event hosted by Roscoe Mountain Club on Saturday from 12 to 5 in Roscoe. There, live music again, all the great things for families, fire pits, and s'mores. You can't have a Winterfest without s'mores, I don't think. I think it's a law. That's Tiffany Conklin from Roscoe Mountain Club.
Thank you so much, Tim.
Thank you, Tiffany. And hey, you did great. You shouldn't be afraid of the radio. Come back sometime.
I'll see you at Winterfest.
Okay, thanks. Take care.
All right.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. For a list of what's going on in our area, you can check our community calendar. It's at WJFFradio.org. Just click on the community tab there at the top and click on community calendar. You'll see what's going on. And you can also submit your own event there as well at WJFFradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together. Committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear the new exotic sounds of the Tiger Club, vibraphonist Mark Riddle, and the Martini Kings. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join us where the music is always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Coming up tonight at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Okay, this is weird.
A scientific fluke.
Had you ever seen anything like that before?
No.
That started growing brain matter in a Petri dish.
Scientists just put pieces of human and mice brain on a plate and wired it to a computer.
It's effectively a biocomputer.
Like humanoid, organoid, very sci-fi.
We've created a new category of thing that is maybe alive.
Brain balls.
It is alive.
That's on the next Radiolab.
Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Taking a look at the forecast, the bitter cold continues. Today, we will see a couple of flurries late this afternoon, but no accumulations. High of 18, bitterly cold tonight. -7 is the actual temperature, but that real feel, of course, is going to go much lower. It'll stay cold all week. Tomorrow, we're looking at afternoon flurries again, 16 for a high. Friday's high, only 8. 16 and 17, the high for Saturday and Sunday. There's a chance for snow on Sunday. You may have heard, if you've been on social media or just checking out the weather forecast, that there's a potential coastal storm. We're keeping an eye on it. It's still too early to tell whether that will dump any snow on our way or we'll just go out to sea. So we'll keep an eye on it as we get closer. But again, bitterly cold, a reminder that warming centers are open throughout our area, and you can find a list of those at WJFFradio.org. Tonight on the Local Edition, you can find out more about winter high school sports, an update from the Sullivan County Democrat on what's going on in sports tonight on the Local Edition at 6. On Point is next.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. What does recovery look like a year after the devastating fires in Los Angeles? Who gets to rebuild? Who leaves? That's this week on Latino USA. Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming online at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.